listening to the Nerds Assemble podcast.
Oh my god, guys. It's episode 200 of the Nerds Assemble podcast!
Woo!
Yay!
Bloody hell. I don't know how this has happened with the fact that over the past year it's become kind of difficult to record episodes due to mostly health issues.
Health, sometimes just not being available and...
And work. Oh yeah, my god. But we're here.
Live.
Had issues.
And despair up the planet.
Yeah. Rather than having like a quiz involving people placed all over the world trying to answer questions over Google Hangouts.
What kind of crazy people would do that?
I don't know. Maybe us. And the fact that it takes far too much organisational skills. But seriously, it does. And with how... Certainly how I've been over the past year. It's a bit awkward to pin me down to get me to help see something like that.
It's kind of awkward to pin you down for anything.
Oh, is it now? So it's not Nerds After Dark, Paul?
Yeah, I was going to say, is this the wrong one?
For this 200...
I'm wearing the wrong things for this one.
So I'm Emily.
I'm Paul.
I'm Paul, a.k.a. Cookie Staying Quiet.
And I'm Paul, a.k.a. Retroid scratching his nose.
For this episode of Nerds Assemble, so rather than doing our usual... discuss a thing, tell people what we've been up to, but I just want to point out I've been playing Final Fantasy 15 and I've yet to be impressed. We're going to talk, each of us are going to talk about five sort of like kind of geeky, nerdy things, media texts or bits of hardware or whatever that have heavily influenced us over the years or recently. I'm sure you can guess what one of mine might be based on that sentence alone. And so each of us is going to talk about five things. And then the hope is that in sort of like coming episodes, we will go into some of these, if not all of them, a bit more in depth. Mm. And talk about them. And maybe if people are willing, maybe those who share an equal passion for some of these things, they might come in on the episode as well. I'm mostly thinking Martin Lejeune, if you're listening, like talking Star Trek.
Because that's bound to be on at least one of our things.
Yeah.
At least three.
I think this is just, you're using this to recruit people into Supernatural. That's all it is.
What are you talking about? I'm not even leading with Supernatural, but it's on there.
Not leading.
Let's start with you, Emily. With what have been your five big influences?
I'm not going to tell you all from the straight off. I'm going to do it one by one, but you know that Supernatural's probably coming up.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Probably.
Probably. I was going to start with the Harry Potter novels, actually. And despite the fact that in when did I start reading them? I started reading Harry Potter novels in early 2000, and it was not with the first novel. It was with the third, Prisoner of Azkaban.
Harry Potter and the Chamber of Spoilers.
Yeah. when my family used to show up down in the local Tesco's and when there was still the book wars going on for pricing and stuff.
the book wars.
The book wars, for which Waterstones and the like perhaps didn't come out as on top as they would have liked. I saw a cheap copy of the recently released paperback version of Harry Potter and the Prisoner of Azkaban. I bought it.
How old were you when you...
So if this is early 2000, so I would have been 13.
Okay.
Oh, God.
which is... Don't think about this a minute. So that's technically also the age that Harry would have been for that novel as well. I read it.
I started reading them to Holly, who's two.
I read it probably, I think, like over the course of a week, which was subsequent books when I actually caught up with everything and like they were being released, you know, new. I tended to read over a weekend to avoid spoilers. I read Prisoner of Azkaban and I got hold of the other two books. And I actually took those three books with me up to London that year when I went on a big trip. And I used them as a means of distraction from all the horrible girls that I was staying in a youth hostel with. I'm not ashamed to say this, but you were all bitches, and Harry Potter saved me from wanting to kill all of you.
You should probably have still killed them.
Harry Potter saved your life.
Yeah, Harry Potter saved your lives, and you don't even know that, you know, because you were all terrible. Unlike The Adventures of Harry Potter and his friends who were always getting him out of trouble. Let's face it, like Hermione Granger certainly was, you know, came on later to definitely be like the main saviour figure of these books, not Harry. I mean, Harry had the destiny, but he didn't have the brains.
All the hard work.
Poor Hermione. And put up with utter bullshit and you know, dealing with the fact that she was best friends with two blokes who, you know, popular psychology would teach us are immature in comparison to herself by several years.
To be fair, that's true of most, you know, kind of relationships cross-gender within that. I'm badly explaining this.
Yes, you are. That's fine.
I'm terrible.
The immaturity.
I think, because obviously, like, whilst I was reading these books, like, the films started coming out probably around the time, was it the fourth or fifth book had come out? Sort of like it wasn't long after, certainly not long after the fourth book, so Goblet of Fire, the first film came out. And that was interesting. And I liked the fact that there was like loads of like paraphernalia and stuff coming out with it, but I loved watching the films in the cinema with like family and friends. But it tended to be the books that I kind of went back to. And I've probably read the first five through about four times. But I have yet to do like a big reread in a long time. So that's sort of like one of the bigger influences. I want to point out that the final book, Deathly Hallows, was published after I'd finished my degree. So ended up sort of like sticking with like the books being sort of published new, not until after I finished my uni studies the first time round. I'm wrong. It was published partway through my degree. Why did I say finished? Because it was 2005. But it was in the summer, so I'd like finished studying for the year. And basically just, rather than reading like some weird literature thing, just went through the final Harry Potter book. Next series, which I got into, this is the next big thing that's influenced me over the years, full thing, is Robin Hobb's Farseer trilogy, which is actually only part, is like the first part of a much wider series of books by Robin Hobb, aka, I've got her real name written down here, Margaret Astrid Lindholm, who's an American author. But she published the Farseer trilogy and a whole wider range of books in the same universe under Robin Hobb. And they are better than the Song of Ice and Fire novels. Like, infinitely really? Better. Yes, there is better characterization and character development going on. People don't always have to die. There's less rape, but yet still somehow a depth of plot and characterization without the need for such violence. And yet there's still plenty of violence in it. In fact, it does get quite bloody at times, but, oh look, rape gets mentioned and shit, but it's still not something that happens all the time. But maybe that's just HBO making it worse rather than the books. If I was someone making TV shows and wanted a big fantasy universe to go into, I would pick that. I suppose Robin Hobb's stuff isn't as well known, so it's about as Harry Potter. It's about the boy wizard who lived. Whereas the Farseer trilogy is about a royal bastard who ends up thrown into a world that is about to go to war. whilst also coming to terms with his place, his lot in life, and also the fact that he isn't 100% normal. And there's sort of like a lot of themes around acceptance of yourself and sort of like how that might be applied to sort of wider personal issues, which make it quite good. But that the Far Sea Trilogy was his first three books. Then there was the Live Ship series, which was other three books, which were even longer. These are all really long fantasy novels, you know. Perhaps even longer than Game of Thrones sort of books at some point.
That took me 5 years to get up to date on that.
Yeah, like this is massive. Like I kind of lost track after about the third series in the universe, but it's something that I would quite happily go back to and put money on to like catch up with. And then I suppose the next most influential thing in terms of everything in my geekish life, Pokemon Blue, the first video game I was ever allowed to own and play. Quite simply, when, you know, Pokemon came to the UK via Sky One, and I used to catch the cartoon at my grandparents.
I want to be the very best.
I mean, I found that really cool, but then I was seeing magazines like the official Nintendo magazine sort of like talk about Pokemon on the front. And obviously it wasn't about the cartoon, it was talking about the games, and it was sort of like, you know, it was the year that the games were coming out.
Yeah.
Over here. So back in 99? 2000 again. I ended up saving money and then getting some sort of like early Christmas present money to help me buy a yellow Nintendo Game Boy Color and a copy of Pokemon Blue. Why Pokemon Blue? Because I preferred the chance to be able to catch Pokemon like Vulpix and Horsea, cool, and sort of like other kind of like blue exclusives versus red. The irony, of course, being that I preferred playing with Charmander a lot of the time rather than Squirtle. Because
you learn that later on, don't you? It's like, oh, hang on.
Yeah. I was always sensible enough not to try the missing egg cheat on my blue cartridge, but I did the following year save up enough money to get myself the red cartridge and sort of like got through partway through red and tried the missing egg cheat to get like lots of like rare candies. Oh my god, did that bugger the game. Like the, what was it called? The Hall of Fame for that like records your Pokemon squads when you defeat the Elite Four. Gets royally buggered when you use the missing go cheat. Like, it just becomes mangled, basically.
What is the cheat?
It was basically, you had to talk to this guy in, not Viridian Forest, outside Viridian Forest, in the town before it. So the second town. And then fly to one of the, or surf to one of the islands near Cinnabar and like surf up and down the side of this island, and then this glitchy thing which got dubbed Missingo, which wasn't really a Pokemon, would appear. And if you did certain things with your item slots and stuff, you could get loads of a particular item, so say rare candies, which are actually quite useless at the end of the day because they just raise the level of your Pokemon. Rather than more important things like attack, speed, defense, and stuff. So, yeah, so that's Pokemon Blue. Next most influential thing, even though I probably haven't played as much of it as The Sims, which is probably the second video game series I seriously got into other than Final Fantasy series, but the first Western RPG that I ever played, which was The Elder Scrolls 3 Morrowind.
That never went anywhere for you.
Yeah, that never went anywhere for me. It was the first game that I bought for my first laptop, which had been initially sort of bought for me to write, you know, important essays and stuff on. But a girl's got to have some downtime, you know, while studying on the International Baccalaureate. I went into Console Connections, which is small sort of indie chain, And I sort of gave my specs and said, oh, you know, so I like playing sort of Final Fantasy there, but is there anything kind of like a bit more not Japanese, basically, that's like a role-playing game? And it's like, oh, yeah, there we got some second-hand, you know, when there used to be second-hand PC games, second-hand copies of this, and he gave me like a day on release sort of like second-hand copy of Morrowind to look at and had the map and everything. So, oh, yeah, this looks all right. Okay, sure. And bought that and then played a summer trying to get used to sort of like a sandbox world for the first time.
Yeah, that'll have been quite a step up after something so linear as, you know, the Final Fantasies.
Oh, yeah. But at the same time, I really liked being able to, like, customize my character so much, you know, and, like, really affect how they developed. And even now, because I've started that game so many times, I will sometimes, certain things I'll like think about, and it will make me think about one of the first sort of bits of dialogue that you deal with, which is the guy that helps you say what your class is and everything.
Yeah.
And he says, there are a few ways we can do this and the choice is yours. And then everything for picking your class comes up, and every now and then I like that audio, like in his voice, will just pop up in my head. Usually when I have to make a choice about something. And then finally, because we're each having 15 minutes each to talk about these five things in brief.
Maybe just over.
Just over. Finally, Supernatural, which is the newest thing to heavily influence my life.
Do you watch that?
I don't know, do I? I suppose I watch it.
That's on them as well.
Yeah, I just happened to watch it. It's not like I got two tattoos because of it, and I've got a third on the way. Hopefully the last Supernatural tattoo, I would like to say
never
at this
say
point.
Last.
It won't be my last tattoo. It probably won't be my last tattoo, but I'm planning on it being my last Supernatural tattoo.
You see, the way you say that, it's as if they just sort of sneak up.
Yeah, I usually plan it, unfortunately, well in advance, because the tattoo parlor I go to is like usually booked up several months in advance. So Supernatural, where I'm a Sam girl, but I love Team Free Will, and it's the first thing that I've been seriously into that got me reading fanfic and actually writing it. So that's a big step up, just kind of like being involved in fan communities and stuff, because I've never been as involved with fan community stuff before getting into Supernatural. I think it's because the female fan base is actually quite visible for it. And quite, well, sometimes supportive, sometimes self-destructive, versus sort of fan bases for other shows which tend to be quite male-led. And thus less supportive of fan works. Unless, of course, it's like fan art of like female characters with their tits up. In which case, male fans are incredibly supportive of it normally for some reason.
Yeah.
And that's all I've got time for, so we have to go on to somebody else now. Those are my five things. Retroid.
I'll volunteer, shall I?
Yeah. Paul's got a timer. Should he start?
No.
He's going to start? That's
pointless, isn't it?
No, use 15 minutes.
Yeah, this is going to be difficult.
Use them wisely.
Use them wisely. Okay.
I never use time wisely.
Okay, I'm going to say...
If you prefer, then I could actually split into 3 minutes each.
Yeah.
Oh, no, that's going to be worse.
Yeah, okay.
But it could be quite amusing and a good challenge.
No, let's just go for 15 minutes. All right. The timer is starting now.
Right. Well, okay. Growing up in the technological Stone Age, basically life on Mars TV series, that's very close to, you know, my memories of. We didn't have PCRs until, you know, I was well into school. And, you know, the whole idea of being able to even choose what you were watching was, you know, a bit of a revelatory moment. But actually being able to control what was on the screen blew my tiny mind. And I used to, after school, go around to the neighbor's house, and he had an Atari 2600. So I'd play some of the games on that. I have no idea what the games were. I just know that he had awful taste. So none of the ones that I now know were good on that system. He had. I just remember he had the original wood grain machine, and I played stuff like Pong and various things on it. And of course, friends at school had the some of the the TV Pong things, which I've discussed before, and they're more electronics projects of really interesting. How on earth did you manage to get that with the technology? Because they didn't have processors, most of them. They were fiddling about with timers and actually manipulating the scan lines on the TV specifically. But yeah, anyway, the first actual machine I had to play games, other than say knockoff Game and Watches, was the Philips VideoPack G7000. And everyone says, oh, yes, the Philips VideoPack G7000. We all know that very well.
That is a mouthful.
Yeah. I think it was a rebadged Magnavox Odyssey 2. Something like that. But I have a grand total of one game. That's all I ever had for it, because that's all I ever saw. And and that was Space Invaders. So I suppose, aim high. Once you've got a version of Space Invaders that you can play at home.
Classic.
And it was colour.
Way.
Yeah. Colour. Look, it was awful. I mean, yeah, it makes the Atari 2600 look amazing. But it was one of the only things that I saw around at the time. Moving on a little bit. Around about the same, very similar time, I got an MB Vectrex, which, again, I mentioned before, vector graphics, very cool. But this was mostly because I think the parent company had, this was part of the video game crash in America. So they were basically just, cutting and running. Right, that's it. Video games are over, because we're stupid and we think Atari was, the whole thing. It's a fad. It's gone. We're getting out. So I ended up getting about six games, £5 each or something, in about 1984.
Cool.
But one of the main drivers for me was family, little trips, like half term, end of term, going for, or like a week or 2 weeks down to Blackpool with my mother and my grandmother. And we'd stay there, and we'd do the touristy things during the day, and I'd be the typical whiny little shite. But when it came to the evenings, I'd drag them to the arcades, the seafront arcades. And that was just amazing to me, because all these machines, where the entire reason for them existing was to play video games. And it was great. And my mum and my nan would just like go to the little cafeteria area where, the creche for parents. And, sit there while I just went around with my, allotted £2 or something, because most of the games were 10 pence per credit. So, I'd go around and just choose the games I wanted to play and, have my fill and, sit on the giant plastic bike kind of, arcade game. So, obviously, I wanted more stuff like that at home. And for, I think it was Christmas, I got a Commodore 16. That was 84, 85, something like that. But I was about 10. And that was the first time that I had a computer. And one of the amazing things about that was I could not only buy games for it, and there were budget games. So, we'd go on the weekly shop to like Asda or wherever it was, and I'd be able to pick up a game. And that was my price, for going shopping. So, I'd pick them up, and they would be absolutely amazing. And, well, to my mind, at that point, again, with the I can actually control what's going on the screen. And one of the massive advantages of the machines back then, as opposed to now, is if you get a gamer's machine, you know, if you got a gamer's machine in the 1980s in the UK, it would be a computer and it would have BASIC. When you started it up, you had to either load the game or you could fiddle about with writing, you know, 10 print Paul is great. 20 go to 10. And you could have a play around with that. There were magazines at the time that would have type-ins. You'd type those in, and it wouldn't be unusual for them to have an error in the listing, so you could, you know, go through it. And again, it was a way of learning coding and logic and mathematics, because some of it would be, you know, working with variables, which of course is basically algebra. So by the time in school we got to algebra and everyone else was going, what's this with x? You know, if x equals 5, how can it do that? And I was, oh yeah, I've already done this. So, you know, I was ahead in that, and yeah, I enjoyed programming. And as a consequence of that as well, which ties in with stuff I'm doing at the moment, joysticks would break because they weren't micro-switched. They would just leaf switch, as they call them. And, you know, the way they work is if you tilt the joystick, then it would move a bit of, you know, bent metal, and it would contact with another bit of metal, which wasn't bent, and it would be able to read that direction. And because leaf switch is awful, that would sometimes break, or, you know, the bit of metal, if you pushed it a bit too far, it would bend a bit too far the other way, and then it wouldn't make contact again. So I'd have to take them apart and then try and work out how they worked. So I remember having several Frankensticks going up to the Amiga days, where the micro switches, you know, came in, you know, much more. So, you know, they were far more reliable and you didn't have to do that. But that was one of my first bits of trying to work out electronics. I had no idea about ground and voltage or anything like that. So, you know, I couldn't do much, but I was starting to work out that if this bit of metal touches that, then it equals this on the computer. So I was playing about with that. You know, then got into the, you know, the Amiga, and as part of that, suddenly this thing called the internet became a thing. You may have heard of it.
I've heard it could become a crucial part of everyday life.
Well, according to a girl at, well, I say a girl, woman at a work placement I was at right after me leaving school, oh, it'll never catch on because it's just adverts for companies, isn't it?
Wow.
In her defense, this was like midnight, you know, sort of mid-late 90s. So there were a lot of, you know, the internet didn't have the, you know, the more accessible, you know, search engines and portals.
Yes.
There was no social media. The only social media, I mean, one of the things which, you know, boggled my tiny mind was for so long I had been aware of certain authors, either of utility software or applications, or people who were working on the computers themselves and the, you know, the system software, you know, game makers, or, you know, all of that. And suddenly I could email them.
Yes.
And ask them a question, and I would get a response. And because, you know, it was very early days, basically it was, you know, a few people who were fiddling with, you know, getting an internet connection, and it was mostly university people who were, you know, on the internet at that time. So it was easier to get a direct answer from someone because it would be a lot friendlier. So it would be, hello, I love your software. Whatever it is you're doing. Are you going to be doing a new version? And they'll come back and say, yes, I am. And go, hurrah. When? I don't know. Okay, I'll wait. Hooray. So yeah, that was all part of that. And then of course I got into mailing lists and internet forums, which were basically the precursors to social media. It's like all, you know, all these I've described to friends who are a little bit about social media that things like Twitter and Facebook are like, you know, big all-encompassing sort of mega forums.
Yes.
And you can choose, well, the idea is you can choose who to have on it and whether they're any good or not, but in practice I don't know whether. Yeah.
Yeah.
But that's how I pretty much use them since, you know, I got on the net. Throughout all of that, because I was fiddling about with, you know, computers and playing other games, what, of course, sci-fi cropped up a hell of a lot in games because it was one of the easiest things to do. You know, there weren't that many historical reenactments of the trials of, you know, Richard III, trials and tribulations of, you know, English history. It was mostly shoot the alien or do something weird because you're on Planet Zob, you know, whatever. So I was watching as much sci-fi as I could get my hands on because it was my genre of choice. All this, oh no, you can only be, you know, Star Trek or Star Wars fan. It's like, nope. Watch both. Watch Doctor Who. Watch Space 1999. Watched Blake 7. Anything that was even vaguely sci-fi, and I'm not joking, anything even vaguely sci-fi, I would watch. And then, of course, I got a VCR in my room. And that was, you know, oh, God, I can have 6 hours of whatever the hell I want off TV. And I can just, I would get the listings magazines and I would just mark down everything I wanted. Because one of the great things was the regional ITV stations would pick up lots of cheap crap that they'd bought. And they'd show them at 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, which was terrible if you were wanting to watch them live. But you'd have all this genre TV showing late night, and it would vary region to region. So you'd get people who were catching up on all these weird little sci-fis or sitcoms, or sci-fi sitcoms, and just, you know, sprinkled all over the country at different rates. But of course, when the internet came along, you could start talking about which ones to watch. And there would be fan sites. But, yeah, so, you know, sci-fi. I got, mostly because, of course, Doctor Who got cancelled.
Boo.
Boo. It was shit at the time. They did run it into the ground. It was
they
shit.
Did. The scripts were pants.
Yeah. It was sub-kids TV type crap when, you know, when they cancelled it. But that was a choice on their part. That, you know,
I was a kid.
But let's see, 1987, they decide to do a new Star Trek series. How's that going to work? This doesn't have Kirk and Spock and McCoy and Scotty. What the hell's going on here? This isn't going to work. Yeah, that didn't last long for me because I very quickly became massively into Star Trek The Next Generation. I would, you know, watch on TV. I would keep catalogued, time-coded episodes written on the tape, collections recorded off TV, and share them, you know, with friends who are at college and such, who, you know, were also watching it. And then, of course, I was buying the books and I was reading those. That was another thing as well. I've discovered that I've got a hell of a lot of book adaptations because before a certain point, it was hell to try and get hold of recorded TV programs. So I've got the novelization of Airwolf, a novelization of Automan, a novelization of Battlestar Galactica, as in, you know, the original, you know, pilot that they did in, you know, like, just after, oh, hang on, this Star Wars thing is popular. Maybe we should do a sci-fi thing. So, you know, I've got a big pile of, you know, book adaptations. So yeah, I was, you know, I was reading the books, I was reading the spoiler magazines, I was buying the technical manual. I've got a Klingon dictionary on my bookshelf. No, I'd never learned Klingon. Because why would I? It's Klingon.
Your 15 minutes is up.
Oh, almost.
Okay.
And then, of course, is the thing which I'm, you know, mostly onto at the moment, and I've talked about it on, you know, on this podcast several times, but it all ties in with things I was interested in the 80s and 90s as well, because I'm into the electronics. And now I'm more into figuring out how to make things and build things in hardware than I am in writing them in software. So I've kind of gone full circle there. I was always fiddling about with the electronics bit, but that was mostly out of just necessity. If something broke and the joystick cost you 30 quid and you're in the late 80s and you're at school, you want that joystick to work. So you'd best try and work out how the hell you can get it working again. So, yeah. And of course, now I'm building joysticks and I'm back to playing around with my Commodore 64.
Sweet.
So, yeah. To, you know, coalesce, I am a big nerd.
And we love you for it.
Aww. Definitely. Bless you.
I managed to almost keep that down to 50 minutes.
I'm impressed.
Yes, yeah.
So, very impressed.
I can breathe now.
Cookie!
Howdy, hi. Okay, so my five would be the first one, if you've been listening to the podcast for ages, you'll know, is Doctor Who. Probably my favourite sci-fi series ever. I have fond memories of watching this at tea time with my mum and dad. It was like a tea time affair for all of us.
Tea time on Saturdays, wasn't it?
Yes, and I remember Peter Davison was the first Doctor I actually remember watching.
Oh, I remember watching Tom Baker.
Oh, Tom Baker was brilliant when I actually caught him and watched him. But to begin with, it was just a family thing. We used to get together, watch Doctor Who. I remember actually being in my high chair at the time.
Blimey.
Which is quite scary, yes. But it's something that's followed me throughout my life as I've made decisions, gone on to things. And it's the whole mystery of the Doctor, who is he, his heritage, why does he do the things he does. It's the whole character that's been built up over the last nearly, what was it, 53 years now?
Yeah.
Something like that. It would be something like 53 years now. Then I remember going to junior school and Sylvester McCoy had come along as the Doctor. A lot of my friends had become very big Doctor Who fans. We actually used to play Doctor Who in the yard.
Yeah.
Their Doctor and me getting stuck as one of the companions, who I always had to play as Ace, because it was the only companion I really, really liked. She was quite bolshy. Then I remember it becoming more of a family thing again by actually spending some time with my granddad, bless him. And when I used to go and stay with him, we used to actually watch the reruns on UK Gold on Sky. And he introduced me to John Pertwee and Tom Baker. And as for your novelizations, at this point, I would actually be biking down to a local bookshop in the little town every 2 weeks with my pocket money and buying the ordering novelizations to pick up the following Saturday and paying for them and spending my time reading them. So I would say it's had quite a big effect on me. A lot of it is to do with escapism, which is why I like a lot of the stuff I've put in my top five. At the time, when it helped create who I was, purely because of kids being around school, as Emily said, not always the friendliest bunch, unfortunately. I'm just as guilty as that when I was younger, and then got on the wrong end of it myself. So, yeah, so that would be the first one, and probably the biggest impact. Second one is 8-bit video games. So as Retroid laughs at me every time I mention this, I used to have an Amstrad CPC 464.
Well, someone has to.
Exactly. But I used to love playing the games on it. I used to love being able to escape and pretend to be somebody I wasn't and just run around causing mayhem in these games. I remember Dizzy the Egg very fondly. I also remember there's quite a few Hanna-Barbera games as well, which I think Codemasters did.
High-tech software.
High-tech, yes, high-tech. Then there was the movie tie-ins for Motion, RoboCop, that sort of thing. But then my biggest entry into it and my biggest sort of entry into gaming was when I saved up for my 8-bit Sega Mega Drive. Ooh. I remember I'd actually gone out to a friend who'd got the AE Master System version 1, which was quite big and ugly.
Although I always quite liked the original 8-bit. You know, well, the Master System, because it was very angular. Yeah.
Yes, that's how I remember it as a kid. Now when I go back, I actually prefer the style of the Master System 1. But at the time, they just launched, I'd been playing this with my mates for quite a few months. I'd got a paper round, so I was saving up my money.
Mm.
And the Master System 2 was released with Alex Kidd. Built in.
Yeah.
And I remember saving all my pennies and then heading into the city with my mum and dad and saying, I want to buy this Master System. And I remember coming home and I absolutely loved it. Brilliant. Alex Kidd looks, when you look at him now and look back at it, he does look like a weirdo, but he was a cool weirdo, especially with his little punching glove that seemed to increase bigger than his body whenever you punch something.
I do remember
Alex Kidd is pretty much, forgotten now, really, yeah. Isn't it?
I mean, it's
a shame.
It is. Alex Kidd was great, but then of course he got replaced by Sonic the Blue Hedgehog, and history for Sega was made. Bless him.
I did find it weird with Alex Kidd how I believe it was a Miracle World where you basically had a best 2 out of 3 with rock paper scissors.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. And that was quite good fun. And then you had the levels where you had like a motorbike. You were riding a motorbike and other bits, which was quite cool. But the one thing I always remember about Alex Kidd was it used to infuriate me because of how difficult it was. So you'd be going along at quite a pace. You'd know the levels quite intricately. And then suddenly you'd mistime a jump by 1 second and you were dead. And it restarted the whole fucking game. But it was brilliant. And I will. Big connection up. To be fair, that was probably is the reason I'm more of a console gamer now than a PC gamer. Due to that little console. Bless it.
See, I didn't really. I mean, apart from the really early. This is where I'm going to be very quick with this. Apart from the very early console things, as soon as I got into computers, that was it until like round about the Saturn and PlayStation kind of era.
Yes. Yeah, no. Master System, I went from the Master System to Mega Drive to the SNES. Then I had an NES as well for a little bit, Game Boy, and then I went on to the PlayStation. Which is quite cool. Third one for me was designed in a galaxy far, far away. Bit of escapism again, I think. So I remember the very first film I ever went to see at the cinema with my dad was Return of the Jedi.
Oh.
And that blew my mind away. Just blew me away. All these wonderful characters, different aliens, all interacting, all just having their differences, but having a common goal to defeat the Emperor and the Empire, bless them.
If I may slide back in again, the very first film I remember seeing in the cinema was Battle Beyond the Stars.
Was that with John Boy from the Waltons?
Yes.
Yes. And
George Peppard. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
George Peppard. I remember that. Yes.
Yes. It was quite awful, but I loved it.
I watched it a couple of years ago and I still enjoyed it.
And it's very kitsch. If you enjoy it for that, then it's fine.
Yes.
If you want to watch it and enjoy it for a serious sci-fi, that's a bad thing. I remember just before Return of the Jedi came out, my mother took me to see and this is probably a mistake, you know, when I was probably about 8 at the time, but it was a back-to-back double bill of Star Wars and The Empire Strikes Back.
Yep.
And one of the defining things I remember about that showing was I got a massive headache by the end of the film. So the defining crescendo of Empire Strikes Back with Obi-Wan never told you about your father. I was whinging that I had a headache and I wanted to go home.
No.
So if I had a time machine, I would go back and slap myself. So, no, this is important. Watch that. Screw
my head. I kind of want to get a time machine, go back to that cinema and go, Trekkie.
To be fair, though. This is what threw me, because I had actually watched Return of the Jedi with my dad at the cinema, but I hadn't watched the rest of them.
I know that I'm not sure.
Because I was a kid, it didn't really make much difference looking back on it, because I just loved it. And as a kid, you don't tend to, you concentrate more on the action and, you know, you don't really follow the storyline as much, I don't think. You're captivated by the big screen lightsaber battles and the lasers and everything. So
it's basically all the action and the cool space things.
So that didn't bother me as much, but it just blew my mind away. And then, of course, I realised that as we went into toy shops, you could buy all the toys. You could, like Boba Fett, who I have on video. My mum's taking me his video when I lived in King's Inn, actually playing with Boba Fett and calling him Rocket Man because I didn't know his name because I hadn't seen the film. So, you know, and I was really big into the toys. Again, it was just a way of escapism for me. And as a kid, you know, flying spaceships, aliens, love it. And all the my friends were around as well, and they all had the toys, and they'd all come around with the toys. We'd set up massive fights between everybody. We didn't really care whose side they were on. I can remember one game where Darth Vader and Han Solo were best of buds and just taking the mick out of Luke Skywalker for whatever reason and blowing him to some Mivarines because he was a bit of a doofus. you know, it was brilliant. And then I remember we actually, Star Wars premiered on ITV after an episode of He-Man, and my dad recorded it on VHS for us. And that was the first time I saw the first one. So I sat back and watched that and I was, wow, this is brilliant. And I could barely remember Return of the Jedi because this was going for a couple of years after. And at this point in time, unfortunately, VHS was still, this was the early 80s, so VHS tech, you weren't really able to go out and buy stuff on VHS readily or very cheaply as it became.
Well, so,
just put the blank VHS and stuck in the thing to record the TV channels.
Yeah, I remember films being on sale in the local video store, but you're talking about £70-80.
Yes.
So we did, per film.
Exactly. So we didn't have them. So this, to actually record Star Wars and have it on VHS to watch it every single time, was mind-blowing. And then, about 3 years after, I remember my dad coming home with a big grin on his face. And he had actually been able to get a copy of Empire Strikes Back on VHS. And that was the first time I'd actually seen that. But it was quite cool because you were a kid in that, you tended to forget the things you'd seen in Return of the Jedi because I was so young. So in reality, I still managed to watch them in the same way, even though I started off with Return of the Jedi with a very vague memory of it, which was great. And I have been into it ever since. After that, my granddad, bless him, he had a 486 PC.
Wow, an absolute powerhouse.
Powerhouse. And he'd just gone and bought it, and he bought me X-Wing by LucasArts.
Oh.
Play on it, and he loaded it up for him, bless him. I still remember his face when it lit up, and I was just there going, oh my God, wow. And ever since then, it's just been one of those things that I've never been able to give up. Like you, Star Trek, I've got novelizations upstairs. I've got a 4-foot Darth Vader toy in the bathroom. Chewie t-shirts, the works, you know. It's just something that
I will have to tweet out the picture of my art.
Yeah. Pardon?
That's not a Nerds After Dark. That's the actual art I have.
And that is my biggest regret, is I got rid of all my toys.
Was, to my amazement, I've got toys I can't really remember.
Blimey.
I kind of vaguely remember, but it's not like, you know, oh yeah, I've got X and X, you know, X toy, but it's just, you know, going through the loft and go, what the hell is this? I don't remember having this, and then it kind of vaguely, you know, comes back to you. But yeah, I've got an AT-AT, a Millennium Falcon, I think I've got a Snowspeeder somewhere, possibly an X-Wing.
Okay, Cookie.
You know.
Your 15 minutes. Have you got Cookie?
To be fair, he's probably only used 14 because I've gapped.
Cookie? Where's Cookie?
Oh, no, have we lost Cookie?
No, I'm still here. Okay, I'll make it quick. Retroid's already covered this, Star Trek The Next Generation. Like Retroid said, I didn't give a monkeys, although the original Star Trek was more of a... I watched the main movies. I didn't bother with the series. Star Trek The Next Generation came along and blew me away. And I just fell in love with the characters. Simple as that. And then for my last one, teenager, going through teenage life. Mum and dad have got news agents. I'm a chubby little chunk of a monkey anyway. So I'm picked on a little bit at school. I don't really know who I am. And I come across a comic book called X-Men.
Hey.
And that's all I'm going to say about that one. That's my 15 minutes, but...
Okay. Wow, okay.
Mr. Lewitt, your turn.
I will just interject again, very quickly. Again, don't worry, sorry.
Yep.
But one of the things which is, you know, difficult to grasp at the moment, you know, if you're a big fan of something, is you can just go get the box sets, or you can get something streaming.
Yes.
The only way I was able to catch up on Star Trek was pretty much through my mum has actual, you know, collections of the stories written up in like an omnibus book.
Oh, wow. Cool.
And each episode might be, you know, like 50 pages or, you know, something like that. But, you know, and I vividly remember City on the Edge of Forever being about double the length.
Oh, yes.
But yeah, that was the only way for ages I could catch up on the Star Trek, because you could, you know, the films were on TV, but for years, Star Trek series, I never saw it on TV. And then I remember it, they said, oh, well, you know, we're going to start showing it again. And I specifically went out and bought, you know, like E195 VHS tapes, because the episodes were slightly longer.
And even when they did start re-showing again, or when they showed it originally, they actually refused to show, I think it was 4 or 5 of the main episodes anyway.
Well, yeah, because there's certainly one episode I remember being banned in this country was one which was sympathetic towards Republican terrorism. So, yeah.
Yeah. So that that was another thing as well. If you watched a series on UK TV, it was almost inevitable it was going to get fucked about with in one way or another. Because someone somewhere wouldn't like, you know, either they wouldn't like the allegory that they were taking, or they just wanted to play it extremely safe and avoid any hassle.
To be fair, this still happens to this day with children's shows that are edited for the European market, and somehow you end up with lots of sort of like innocuous stuff being taken out because it's a bit too gay or trans or something, which is terrible. And I'm looking, I think, either at Cartoon Network, Nickelodeon, or both. In this regard,
I know they're a little bit guilty of that.
Yeah. We mentioned it with Steven Universe. Guilty.
They've done it with Adventure Time a few times as well, or at least the comics have.
Yeah, when they showed a few series, you know, when they had got stuff like Dragon Ball for the market, I remember hearing about this. There were several characters that went on a holiday.
Interesting. Yeah,
the kind of holiday where they all float down here. But it's just, Japanese version died, shown in China, subtitled and such, died.
Okay, Paul, so what are your five most influential bits of thing?
Okay, well, for me, I'll start at the very, very beginning, which for me was actually a game called Dizzy. I think somebody mentioned that earlier.
Yes.
And that was the first kind of video game that I really got into, because before then, it was always kind of arcadey type, kind of get as high a score as possible. And when you don't really go to arcades very much because, for a starter, it was poor. Second of all, traveling to town or city that had one was kind of, that didn't happen. So I was always kind of reliant on, home entertainment for that kind of respect. And Dizzy was kind of the first kind of video game that kind of seemed like it had kind of more of a main character and characterization to it. And it was also like a different game because it wasn't like shooting enemies or anything like that. It was always kind of logic and puzzles.
They called it a cartoon adventure.
Yeah, absolutely, and it really was. It was also probably one of the first video games that I played that actually had iterations of it, so like sequels. So, say for example, in I think it was Fantasy World, is it, which was third one along. You obviously had like a rat at the top, the like starting screen and whatnot, and if you kind of got into contact with him, then you die. So you basically found like a stale loaf of bread in the dungeon where you kind of were trapped, and use that to get out and whatnot. And a similar type thing happened with I think Prince of the Yoke Folk, which was actually the only Dizzy game that I actually managed to complete, because these were quite hard.
Difficult.
And, yeah.
Oh, isn't that the case of one of the ones bugged out and you couldn't get past a certain point anyway?
I'll talk about that in a second.
Okay.
By the way, I have checked up and you are right. Fantasy World Dizzy was the third game.
Hmm. And so Prince of the Yoke Folk, which I think is technically the sixth game, but it felt more like five because Spellbound Dizzy was so much more advanced than the rest of them. Prince of the Yoke Folk started similar type thing where you're in a dungeon, but there's kind of a wooden door and you have to basically use the torch in the room in order to set a pile of leaves right next to the door alight, which then burns down, sets the door aflame, and then use the jug of water in order to put out the flames. So from the very beginning, you're kind of puzzle solving, you're kind of thinking about like the logistics of what items do what. Going to the Spellbound Dizzy, where if you had the 48K version, I think there must have been like a bit of the code which didn't line up correctly, because in order to get, I think, the Shamrock from the duty, can't remember what his
Don't look at me. I've not played these
Leprechaun.
Games.
You kind of have to kind of give him an item or something like that, and the dialogue box never actually come up on the 48K version.
Whoops.
Yeah. I mean, there are so many different improvements on the 128K version from the 48K version. That was just like a joke. And bearing in mind that these are video games where you kind of, you put them onto the TV and they took about half an hour to load up as well. So it's not like nowadays where, you know, you kind of stick it in and you're kind of playing within like...
except for Final Fantasy 15, Paul.
Very true, very true.
Or The Last of Us.
Yeah. But I mean, these are like, you know, if the game crashes, you have to do that 30 minutes kind of start up all over again.
I will just step in their defense and say it's actually more like 10 to 15.
What, for what?
To load a 128 gear.
Oh, right.
Game up. But yeah, it's still, you start it off and you go and do something else.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I remember because it was like, you know, the only TV in the house that I was kind of connecting to, it meant that, you know, you're kind of loading up a game for like, you know, 10, 15 minutes onto a TV that nobody else could kind of watch from then on, in essence. And even
while
then, because
while it screeches.
Yeah. Because they were on tapes as well, that means that if the sound wasn't quite right, if the connections were out and whatnot, it didn't load properly. So that was always a risk. So Dizzy, you know, first kind of first video game that I really kind of heavily got invested in. I mean, this is somewhere around that, when I actually first started to, you know, kind of play video games like Dizzy and whatnot. And I remember actually coming down before school about 7 o'clock in order to kind of load it up and, you know, try and, you know, make my way through the game. So, the second one on my list, we've talked about already, Star Trek. My experience started out with Next Generation, and once again, it's kind of this idea of problem solving a lot of the time. So, yes, you do have like battle sequences and whatnot in the series, but a lot of it was down to, I suppose, in a way, kind of technobabble, which is bad, but also diplomacy, which is good. You know, it always kind of tried to work a way through stuff. And it was never a case of, well, it didn't feel like there was ever a case of kind of us versus them in that respect, because the crews themselves were quite inclusive.
Yeah. I like Next Gen because it was just a coherent universe that had its own rules. You know, you say about the, you know, the techno babble.
Yeah.
But part of the things that appealed to me was that it you know, they had their own science to it.
Yes, definitely. I mean,
didn't just pull something up their arse and say, oh, the wibble wobble spanner isn't working right. You know, that we've never mentioned this before and we'll never mention it again.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, we've actually seen some of those technologies actually come to life. You know, like, you know, for example, the pads and whatnot. Those are pretty much like iPads and whatnot. We've got the kind of semi-equivalent to replicators, which are 3D printers. You know, we've kind of dabbled about with even teleportation a little bit. You know, admittedly only kind of atoms at this point, but, you know, it's kind of there. All the science is kind of there within the Star Trek universe, so nothing seems like it's, you know, too unrealistic.
I was watching a few episodes lately, and you know whether it's especially Geordi when he's talking with the computer and he's, you know, saying lower the light,
yeah,
a little bit more, or, you know, play me some guitar, or you know, yeah, or, you know, asking a question, you know, like what's this, or, you know, something like that. And I've thought, bloody hell, I do that with OK Google stuff.
Yeah.
Not obviously not to the same degree, because it will frequently mishear, or, you know, get something a little bit wrong, or, you know, they won't have that command in there. But yeah, I set timers and check the weather and, you know, blah blah, and tell it to load apps and, you know, things like that. And it's getting there.
Absolutely. And it's, you know, it's got a massive scope and massive possibilities. And I think the one thing that is lacking today is the fact that, you know, everything seems to be quite pessimistic, you know, and Star Trek is just so optimistic. It's, you know, brilliant. You know, most sci-fi series, you know, they're either kind of dull or they're, you know, kind of very political, and they're not really, you know, very optimistic in certain respects. I mean, say, for example, Babylon 5 was, you know, one where it's like, you know, Babylon 5 is meant to be this glimmer of hope, but it kind of isn't at the same point. It isn't at the same time.
Well, what was it, third season for that? With the Babylon 5 was our last best hope for peace. It failed.
Exactly.
And then lots of explosions and death.
Yes.
And that was in the intro sequence.
Yes.
It's like, oh, that went well. Okay.
But yeah, I think to a certain extent, I think my optimism probably stems from Star Trek. Yeah. Anyway, I'll move on to my next one, which is Team Fortress 2, which I know is probably kind of a bit of a weird one.
I'm actually surprised by that.
Why is that?
I would have thought it would have been GoldenEye.
I liked GoldenEye, and it was, you know, kind of relevant to my childhood. But I think Team Fortress 2 was the one that actually kind of differentiated itself, because you know, it was kind of an online game, so you're playing with real people and playing over the internet. That was, you know, the first time that I've really got into online play, and I think it's probably the only time that I've actually got into online play in kind of a big way. And you know, part of the thing with that is that you are kind of playing as, you know, kind of teams. You know, you're part of a team. And okay, so you don't always end up interacting with your team members and, you know, supporting them as much as you could do. But there was that, you know, kind of thing there whereby, you know, if you were support, you could be support, you could be the engineer, or, you know, that there's so many different roles that was, you know, that you can play as, and you can play to your strengths, or you could try and play to what the team needed at the time. And
of course, you bloody love hearts.
Yeah.
In real life, I'm the one that actually likes hats in real life and wears a lot of hats.
But I mean, the one thing that strikes me with Team Fortress 2 is that it is effectively balanced. Each time they bring in an update, they, you know, kind of rebalance stuff so that no weapon or no character has a clear advantage in too many situations, you know. So you will have, say, for example, the sniper being, you know, sort of like the complete opposite end of the spectrum to the pyro. And, you know, you will have the spy that, you know, is, you know, really, really good against, like, say, for example, a heavy, because he can cloak, but is really ineffective against pyro. And, you know, you just have, like, these different roles that do kind of supersede and are weak against each other. And that's just, you know, really fantastic. And I think, to a certain extent, it's the first video game that also has actually felt like a service rather than just like a, you know, an entire package by itself. You know, with the amount of updates that it has gone through and iterations that it's gone through, you know, you feel like the game has evolved, even if you know, to an outside perspective, it is just more hats being added. You know, that there are more weapons which do, you know, slightly different things and, you know, have different stats and whatnot, but, you know, it is something that's, you know, say, for example, the updates where I think you're not just like extra maps, but extra game modes and stuff as well. And those kind of kept on being added. I'm not sure, because I've lost touch with Team Fortress 2 now, but, you know, at the time it was just absolutely, you know, fantastic. Just felt kind of really alive, especially for a game that was, even at that point when I got into it, was good, like 3 or 4 years old, it must have been. And my next one is Sliders TV series, kind of low budget TV series in a way, which, you know, the low budget stuff didn't necessarily attract me as much as the concept of it, which is basically, you know, a group of people that were sliding through parallel universes trying to get home. I mean, I know that's kind of a version of the Odyssey in essence, but the you know, kind of visiting other worlds where history has gone, you know, differently, either due to people or due to natural circumstance. You know, just I love the thought of, you know, there is another universe where Brexit didn't happen or Trump didn't get in or, you know, anything like that. So, but
hang on, I'm just going to get all my electronics kit, I've got an idea.
But I mean, even it's kind of influenced me in my tastes towards sci-fi as well. So I really like, you know, storylines of like what ifs, like, you know, the mirror universe in DS9 and stuff, and
Even like the What If kind of mini comic type things in Marvel as well. I found those really, really interesting.
That is a rich vein of sci-fi, which I don't think is explored enough.
Absolutely not, no. I mean, so, it kind of so gets...
Black Mirror is about the only thing I can think of recently that does it.
Yeah, I mean...
Man in the High Castle.
Yeah, Man in the High Castle, as Emily said.
But that's its whole theme, is, you know, it's kind of one alternate.
Hmm. But I mean, you get stuff like...
I like the anthology, kind of.
Yeah, you get stuff like Rick and Morty, which is kind of... They do travel through parallel universes and whatnot, and it does kind of relay into the story ever so slightly, but it's not, you know, kind of... Say, for example, the first episode of Sliders, the pilot episode, basically Quinn kind of gets visited by an alternate version of himself using this technology, and he goes to another parallel world, and he doesn't see a difference at first. The only thing that is different is literally traffic light colours. So instead of green being go and red being stop, it's the other way around. So he, you know, he's obviously kind of, what the hell? Okay, whatever. So it comes back, you know, doesn't necessarily believe that he's kind of visited a parallel universe, and, you know, kind of decides to, you know, kind of venturing on, you know, and happenstance happens?
I don't know.
Stuff happens. Say, for example, he visits other worlds where, you know, family members are still alive. Or, you know, family members are dead, or, you know, all sorts of different, you know, kind of situations happen, which just felt kind of hard-hitting in a way.
I quite like, one of my favourite, well, first of all, I like the Cro-Mags that they had. So that really appealed to me, because it was an alternate species of, you know, humanoid.
Yes.
Or hominid, rather. But one of the things I quite liked was... There's an episode, I think, relatively early on, not the pilot that you described, but they think they've got back to, you know, their Earth.
And it turns out that the Golden Gate Bridge has been painted blue.
It's either blue or it's gold, but it's not red. I can't remember, you know, specifically, but up until that point, everything fits and they think it's theirs.
Yeah.
And then I think one of them's talking on the phone or in a room or something like that, and he just looks out the window, and the Golden Gate Bridge is the wrong colour. And it's just,
I mean, I think that was the tipping part, because I think they kind of made a joke about the Cubs winning the World Series or something like that.
Yeah, but very American, you know, it was just very tiny little things, and it just comes to that, and it's...
I suppose behind the scenes as well, kind of illustrates Chaos Theory, but it's also to do with, because Fox was the one that originally showed it, and that is the first series that I got into where they seriously started screwing up the series because of, you know, studio interference.
Sci-Fi Channel bought that up for a season or two, didn't they?
Yes.
It died on the Sci-Fi Channel.
Yes, because...
It was one of those run-into-the-ground things, wasn't it? Because didn't they replace the main character and they replaced several others?
Yeah, well, I mean, because obviously there was kind of a replacement for Arturo. Then basically they got in like a young, vibrant, you know, woman type thing whose love interest to, you know, Quinn Mallory, because apparently Wade, whatever. Sabrina Lloyd, who played Wade, kind of left the series for the fourth season. They ended up kind of bringing in, O'Donnell's brother? I think it was Charlie O'Donnell or something like that, as his kind of on-screen brother. That's when it went to Sci-Fi Channel, and there was this weird thing where it's like, oh... Yes, this Quinn Mallory is actually kind of refugee from like an alternate Earth that's more advanced, that's already fighting the Cro-Mags, and he has a twin, or he has a brother that's sent on this other Earth, and blah, blah, whatever. Sci-Fi Channel, you know, kind of mushiness. And then the fifth season, basically they decided, because I think, what was it, O'Connell actually decided to leave, and so did his brother. So they basically mushed Mallory into... Or Quinn Mallory and his brother into one person, and they became like just a dude who
you know, wasn't particularly, you know, whatever, who was just called Mallory.
And you could not abide this
Dude. Well, I mean, to be honest, that's when it actually stopped showing on UK TV. And not even the DVD has
probably
been released.
Probably because
UK
TV just went, ah.
Anyway, I've been over, so I will quickly go through the last one, which is Final Fantasy. It's my first introduction to kind of a strategy-based gameplay system. So before now, it's always been like, I didn't really kind of play strategy games, at least even like turn-based at that point. So it kind of felt a bit weird to me, kind of not being able to kind of press the button and kind of attack instantly, you know, like most action games or beat 'em ups or whatever.
Yeah.
I kind of began to kind of get used to it and, you know, realize that the gameplay mechanics were kind of part of the game world and whatnot. And it made sense within the game world, but it wasn't the focal point of the game. With Final Fantasy, it's always been based around, you know, kind of storytelling. And I think Final Fantasy especially has been really good with kind of a convoluted but unreliable narrative type thing with that. So my first foray into it was Final Fantasy VII. You kind of start playing through and it seems kind of relatively linear, you know, basic storyline and whatnot. And then you begin to find out that the story that you've been witnessing is not the, you know, proper story. You know, things aren't adding up. And then things get really confusing and, you know, you find out that basically the character that you play as is unreliable in a respect for how the story's going. I have butchered the explanation for that, but yeah.
And there may be a character death that people are still upset about.
Absolutely. I think it's, a lot of people kind of turn around and say that is like the first time that they've ever cried at a video game because it, you know, kind of tried to introduce that, you know, emotional depth.
They've clearly not had a 48K version of Dizzy.
That's kind of...
Bless you.
Yeah. it had the characters of like the Final Fantasy games, have always been quite different. Obviously, the first couple of Final Fantasy games have like very, very similar characters between them. They started kind of, you know, blonde spiky haired dude with a massive sword, very, very different to big black dude with an arm cannon.
Yes.
And, you know, they kind of played very differently and, you know, kind of seemed like they were different characters rather than just like, you know, pretty much a character that you play as that, you know, may look slightly different to all the other characters, but they play functionally the same. That wasn't the case in, you know, Final Fantasy. I think that's... I've gone over my allotted time. Like you guys.
C'est moi?
Yeah. Okay, so
everyone expected that.
So I think that's all we've got time for. So it's good night from.
It's good night from me, Paul Wood. I'm Retroid on Eurogamer.net and Super Retroid on Twitter.
It's good night from me, Paul, aka one-armed underscore cookie on Twitter.
Okay, it's good night from Emily King. She's on Twitter's EK6. Sorry. EK6891? Yeah, that's right. Yes. And it's good night from me, Paul Blewett. I'm on Twitter's @PaulBlewett. You could find we don't really have show notes for this episode, but, you know, you can find a list of what we've been talking about over at www.nerdsassemble.co.uk. We're also on Twitter, Facebook. On Twitter, we're at Nerds Podcast. On Facebook, we're just, you know, Nerds Assemble. And on Google Plus as well. And I think that's it. So
good night.
Good night.
Good night.